Hi, my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and I'll be moderating today's webinar on collecting on deceased accounts. There are a number of legal, ethical, and professional differences when it comes to collecting on a debt owed by someone who is deceased, and more importantly, collecting with integrity and empathy should be the focus of every creditor and collection agency. Today, a panel of credit and collection industry executives will share their insights and experiences pertaining to this important topic. This webinar is being generously sponsored by LexisNexis Risk Solutions. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is the news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope you'll all spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Tracy Banicki is the Chief Operating Officer of DCM Services and brings 25 years of call center management experience to the DCMS team. Her experience includes customer care through late-stage recovery call center operations, in addition to first-party and third-party roles. She's managed multi-location call centers, including new center acquisitions and integration. Howard Enders is the President and Chief Compliance Officer of Phillips & Cohen & Associates, the globe's leading compassionate deceased account management business and its debt-buying subsidiary, Invenio Financial. Howard has more than 20 years' experience in the credit industry and is currently responsible for all back office and compliance aspects of the U.S. operation. He further oversees compliance and operational support for all international entities, which include the United Kingdom, Ireland, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Spain. Joe Messer provides comprehensive legal representation to many large and small collection agencies, credit reporting agencies, and debt purchasers throughout the nation. He's defended lawsuits brought under the FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA, and many other state and federal consumer protection laws. Joe has served as an Illinois Special Assistant Attorney General, representing agencies such as the Department of Transportation and the Department of Natural Resources. He's also an active member of several professional organizations, including the NABPS, ABA, NARCA, and ACA International, and has received the ACA International's Fellow designation. Dawn Sholian began her career in the ARM industry as a probate care specialist in 1989 with deceased collection agency pioneer Estate Recovery, Inc. ERI was one of the first collection agencies to offer probate collection servicing. Over her career spanning 30 years, Dawn has created multiple databases to assist with recovering estate information, as well as systematic processes to handle claim filings against estates based on various state and county laws. Dawn currently holds the position of Senior Collection Manager in the Probate Collection Department of Sim Associates. Sim is a full-service, nationally licensed ARM company, providing best-in-class deceased care solutions that encompass decedent verification, estate location scrub, proprietary probate tracker claim filing process, and an empathetic survivor recovery solution, all performed with brand sensitivity and regulatory compliance in mind. With that, the format for today's webinar will be a panel discussion. We encourage everybody to submit questions and we'll get to them when the discussion has concluded. To submit a question, please type it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available later today on AccountsRecovery.net. As well, I just wanted to ask everyone to take a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link in your email tomorrow to access the survey. Participating in the survey helps me develop content that is what you're looking for and to find the speakers you want to hear from. With that, let's launch into today's discussion. And first, I thought it would be good as a starting point to maybe frame the discussion and walk through some of the high-level do's and don'ts of collecting on accounts where the debtor is deceased, and maybe talk a little bit about how that's different from collecting on regular accounts. Maybe Howard, you might take that one first.
Sure, it's no problem. Thank you for the introduction, and thank everybody for attending today. You know, I think really the starting point in looking at this is really to say, you know, where do the interests lie? And I think we all, while we, you know, everybody on the phone on the panel does things a little bit differently, it still all stems from a compassionate approach and also making sure that you're protecting your client's brand interests at all times. With that said, a great starting point for anybody who's, you know, who either is familiar with this space or is new to it, is to take a look at the FTC's policy statement that they issued, I believe it was in 2012, which really gives you the framework as to how the FDCPA applies to deceased debt and ties it into the regular collection or conventional collection process.
Excellent. Good start. Does anyone else want to follow on top of that?
Yeah, this is Joe Messer. I think Howard is dead on that. The FTC guidance is helpful because it gives you an idea of what how a plaintiff's attorney is going to be looking at this. If somebody comes to them and says, "Hey, I've been getting," you know, a family member says, "Hey, I've been getting calls and they're demanding that I pay, and I don't know if I owe this or not." I mean, that can be an FDCPA claim, clearly, depending on whether that person is the representative of the estate or not. And the FTC guidance gets into that, explains how the creditor's really not allowed to talk to anybody else except for those who are representing the deceased, typically the executor of the estate or the administrator of the estate. And while it's acceptable to make calls to family members to determine who those folks are, that's really where it ends. It's the location information type call where you're trying to determine who is responsible for this estate. And in that call, you can only really find out who's responsible, and you can't talk about the debt. And then once you do contact that person, then you can generally treat them as you would the debtor, as far as the FDCPA is concerned.
A couple of comments that I will make as well, and this is Tracy, and I'll kind of piggyback off of a couple comments that Howard made about brand and sensitivity. It's important to remember that the reason that the accounts end up getting placed with a specialty agency for follow-up is because the consumer died, and not necessarily because they were delinquent at all. And most often, then when you do end up identifying the person who you have the right to communicate with, as Joe brought up, you're dealing with a party that most often didn't in any way establish the debt from the beginning.
This is Dawn. Very true, Tracy. You know, a lot of times in the deceased collection world, in terms of finding the person who is handling the estate matters, it's basically educating them at that point, because, you know, how often are you aware of, you know, let's say you're, you know, the executor of your aunt's estate. How often are you aware of what her debts or what her assets are, unless she's previously discussed that with you? So it's taking the time to educate the party, guide them in the right direction, not providing them with legal advice, of course, if you're not an attorney, but advising them as to where they can go to get assistance, such as the probate clerk, you know, court administrator, something like that, so that they can feel comfortable with what they basically have been, you know, given to do.
Does that mean it's more of a hand-holding process or a guiding process than it is sort of an actual collections process?
Well, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I would say, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead, Howard.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember, there's nobody, you know, other than some attorneys, who go to school to be an executor of an estate. You know, you're generally dealing with a family member who has never had this experience before, has never had to manage this process, and truly is lost as to, you know, what's being mentioned before. You're going to be going through, you know, bills. You're going to be looking for, you know, if you get named administrator, you may be looking for a will. It could be a situation where it's an informal estate. You just have a bank account that you're trying to figure out what you're supposed to do with. So it's very much a hand-holding and more of an educational process than it is anything else when it comes to this. This is not an area where you're doing, you know, hard line pitches of making demands for money. I mean, you know, for all of us on the phone, we all have, you know, disclosures that we're giving repeated number of times, whether it be in letters or in verbal, you know, conversations with people telling them that they're not personally liable for, you know, for these debts.
Agreed. And I think when it comes to either them contacting you or you contacting them and determining that they are that party, you know, there's several different ways the call could go. It's either they're confused and I need help, or it's I just want to, you know, find out what I need to do, or it's anger because they're so lost. And I think once you bring them back and educate them and let them know that you're here to help them and show them that in deceased collections, it's not, you know, it's not this hardcore thing. It is being respectful and helping someone come to a resolution.
In addition to educating them through a process that they most likely have never had to deal with before, there's also the hugely emotional side of it as well. You may be dealing with a spouse or a child, close sibling, and it's a very emotional process for them as well.
Okay. Well, at this point, what I'd like to do just is briefly pause the discussion, and I'd like to invite Linda Straub-Jones from LexisNexis to say a few words. Linda?
Thanks, Mike, and thanks again to all our great panelists for participating and sharing your expertise today. As many of you know, LexisNexis Risk Solutions supports the credit and collections industry through its comprehensive database of information on individuals and businesses. The information we compile comes from over 10,000 sources and enables us to provide access to over 280 million consumers and 48 million businesses. Our patented matching and linking technology, which we call LexID, assigns a unique and persistent identifier to each consumer. This unique identifier powerfully connects consumer information maintained in those disparate data sources, providing a very comprehensive view of each consumer. Additionally, LexisNexis has a comprehensive database of deceased consumers that currently has 77 million records that come from sources outside of the SSA's Death Master file, plus we also have the SSA's Death Master file. So if you'd like more information about our deceased products or other products, please feel free to contact me. My name and number will be on one of the slides or at our website, risk.lexisnexis.com. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Linda, and thanks again to LexisNexis Risk Solutions for sponsoring today's webinar. As a means of reminding everybody participating that questions are encouraged, we've got a couple of questions that have come in, so would like to just sort of throw the first one out to the panel and see if anyone wants to tackle this one. Can personal representatives be held responsible on the same level as an executor and or administrator?
Well, this is Joe Messer. When you say responsible, I'm assuming that the question is not, are they personally responsible, because they're never going to be personally responsible. Well, I shouldn't say never. They could be in certain community states, and if there's a doctrine of necessities in play, and we can talk about that later. But generally speaking, the administrator or the executor is not going to have any personal liability. But if you're charged with probating an estate, whether you're court appointed or you're named in the will, you have that responsibility to probate that estate, to make sure that those assets are distributed properly pursuant to the probate laws. And if you fail to do that, you've basically breached that obligation as an executor, and you can have a responsibility in that regard. But you will not, an executor typically will not have personal liability to a creditor of a deceased.
And I think in all situations, you know, that we're talking about here, whether it's personal representative, executor, or administrator, there's fiduciary responsibility to the estate and to the creditors to handle it, you know, properly. The biggest difference that you're really going to have with a personal representative, and it's difficult for me to answer, at least from our agency, because we don't force open estates. We're not pursuing anybody, you know, through any legal, you know, framework that way. But you're still going to have a fiduciary responsibility, but where you're an executor or administrator, you're really falling under the court's purview because, you know, to be named the executor, you're probating the will to be, you know, to be handling as the administrator, the court's appointing you as the administrator versus a personal representative, which is really going to go through more of the informal process that would really require you to file an action, even if you wanted to get at somebody.
Well, I'm super glad that the attorneys on the call jumped in and talked about the liability or non-liability factor of that personal representative. I am not an attorney, but I will also add to their comments, which were very valid, that the FTC policy statement also very, very clearly says that not only can you not misrepresent liability, you have to proactively communicate to them that they are not liable.
Yeah, and just to put it in context of where we started, I'm sorry, Joe, I'll stop.
Oh, go ahead, go ahead.
Just that when we started the conversation, I was mentioning about, you know, protecting your client's, you know, brand. This is really an area where, you know, you can have the legal right to do something, but it doesn't mean that you should do it. And in the deceased arena, it's really one where you really have to be careful with what you're doing, because one of the story of somebody going after a personal representative who doesn't owe the debt, who's doing a service for somebody who passed away and is probably a loved one of theirs, and then somebody's going to turn around and go after them in a legal framework. It's just something you need to keep in mind as you go through this entire process, because it's not just, well, I have the legal right to do it, so let's forge, you know, full steam ahead. Something like that hits the newspapers, your company's going to be all over the internet, whether it be from an agency perspective doing it, a law firm perspective, or the creditor doing it on their own behalf. There's no win in that situation.
I think that's a good point. This is Joe again. I was going to say it's interesting that the FTC does put that statement in its guidance that you're supposed to explain to a person that they're not responsible for a debt, but personally responsible. But the interesting thing about that is, as a lawyer, I looked at that and thought, well, maybe that's not entirely accurate, because if a person happens to be in a community property state or in a situation where there's a doctrine of necessity statute that would actually make that person liable for the debt, then you could be telling them something that's not true. So I don't know that the FTC folks thought that through when they put that in the guidance.
I agree, but I think it's, if you take a look at the backdrop of where the FTC policy statement started, was an article in, I believe it was New York Times, where at the time there was a law firm who was doing servicing deceased accounts, and they made a comment that sort of like a don't ask, don't tell when it came to whether the personal representative or the executor was personally responsible for the debt. And then Senator Schumer got involved and wrote to all the banks, and that's where the CID actually came from that led to the policy statement. So I think they were trying to really address a very specific issue as to how the whole thing came about.
You mentioned the policy statement. I'm curious what other rules, laws that govern sort of the collection of deceased accounts that companies should be aware of as they embark or as they take on this this type of debt collection.
Well, certainly if you're doing it in a third party, any third party debt collection laws are applicable, the FDCPA, any state-specific laws. There are some state-specific laws that even call out collection recovery efforts related to deceased accounts. There's certainly that FTC policy statement, which for anyone who enjoys that kind of reading, I think it was released on July 27th of 2011. And of course, any CFPB rules.
Excellent. Anything else that people should be made aware of?
Yeah, there's some things that are in the policy statement that are not going to be in the FDCPA, because what the policy statement was trying to do was sort of define who you could speak to in the course of collecting on these accounts, because you don't have the consumer themselves. And it's not necessarily that you know, where you look at it, when we met with the FTC, there were questions along the lines of, well, if you open the mail for that person, does that make you somebody who you should, an agency should be speaking to? Things along those lines. So what they came up with was the requirement, if you don't know who the, before you do any disclosure, you have to figure out who the proper party is that you're speaking to. And what most of us do is send out a letter that, unfortunately, we're not allowed to disclose really anything in it, but trying to ascertain who the person is, whether it's the executor, administrator, first representative, the individual who's authorized to pay the outstanding bills to the person who's passed away. So a lot of it is driven by not only just outbound calls, but inbound calls, with a very high expectation by the government of maintaining the privacy of the person who passed away. So while they require it, it's somewhat of a hindrance because it makes it, you know, we sometimes refer to it sort of like a creepy letter, because, you know, the executor or the authorized individual, you know, receives a letter that doesn't say who our client is, what the amount is. It basically is, we're looking for the person who's handling, you know, the information for this person. And when they call in, you have to ask them a bunch of validating questions, just like you would have to on any conventional account for any, you know, any of our clients, to validate that you're speaking to the right person. And it doesn't make it a very smooth process, but you won't find the information about sending this locate letter out anywhere other than in the FTC policy statement.
I would say if you are going to try to collect from anybody other than the personal executor, the personal representative of the executor, you need to look to see, obviously, if you've got the right to do that, you need to look and at the particular laws of the state that you're in. So, I mean, some states have very clear doctrine of necessities type laws that say that spouses can be responsible for the medical debts of their spouses, and parents can be responsible for children's debts, that type of thing. But it's pretty complex, and you don't want to just assume that once you see that there's the doctrine of necessities applies, that somehow you can just start contacting those folks. You really need to read the statute, because they have several different nuances.
We've heard the word probate mentioned a few times now today, and I'm guessing there might be a few people on listening in who might not know what it is and how it works. So, Don, I'm wondering if you could take a second and explain what probate is and how it works.
Sure. So basically, probate is the process that's followed through the courts to clear probate assets from the deceased to heirs. And the way I typically explain it when doing any type of training on, a new employee or anybody just in general, you know, they always want to know, like, well, what do you do and how do you do it? And so it's, you know, we always try to make it where we're explaining it in the weeds. Someone has a piece of property that is listed solely in their name, and the heirs want to sell that property, transfer the property, refinance the property, they wouldn't be allowed to do so because that property is not in their name. So certain probatable assets have to flow through the court in order to change hands to the heir. And then, of course, when the probate is opened, then you're opening up for creditors to then address their claim through the court as well to obtain payment on, you know, what they've been deemed by their client.
And to also, an idea was a really good explanation, just to keep in mind, you know, when we talk about an estate, people think about, well, there's only an estate if you have a will and you file it with the court, but everybody who passes away has an estate, whether it's formal or informal. Anything that you leave behind is considered part of your estate. So it's just something as you go through the terminology that I think it gets a little bit tricky sometimes for people.
And Howard, to circle back on that one as well, a lot of people in terms of heirs or, you know, family members, children of the deceased, they automatically make assumptions. A lot of times you'll hear, well, my mother left that to me. okay, well, she left that to you, but did she leave it to you in a legal format where you're a joint tenant or, you know, you're a joint holder of the property? You know, again, we circle back to the education, educating the party who is handling those matters and, you know, making them understand what the probate is and how to address those probate assets.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you know, I think that sort of ties into another question where I, you know, somebody had asked, you know, whether an invoice needs to be sent to next of kin before you could file a claim against an estate, and the answer would be no. You could file a claim whenever you want against the estate. It would function very similarly to a conventional collection account where you're gonna have people requesting the last statement or the you know, verification, but there's nothing that's going to stop you from filing your claim with the estate.
Is there a statute of limitations on how long you have to file that claim?
Yeah, it functions. I mean, it runs differently by state, but they're going to have a bar date, just like, you know, if there's people who are familiar with bankruptcy, there's going to be a bar date, and usually it's going to go from either date of death, from the date of first publication of notice in a, you know, in a newspaper or something, that may start it, but there's various ways. You really have to take a look at each jurisdiction separately, even down to the county level as to what you're going to need to do from a timing perspective.
Yeah, there are actually over 1,500 different county court jurisdictions, and you know, some states are, you know, very broken out, such as Connecticut, where they have all these, you know, different little districts associated.
Or Louisiana, where you have all the parishes.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, the more information you know about each individual state, I think the better off you are. I mean, some of these are so, you know, they're so specific as to color of paper, how they want you to sign, what color pen to use, et cetera.
Wow. Yeah, it's really, because it makes it, you know, more difficult on top of, because where I mentioned bankruptcy before, and you have, you know, PACER and things like that, where there's a national, you know, depository, there isn't anything when it comes to deceased accounts. You're dealing on a county by county basis, and not only filing, but also searching. So you may have a scenario where a person resides in Pennsylvania, but also has a winter home in Florida. They may have two separate probated estates in two different locations. So when you're going through it, it makes it even more difficult as you're trying to make sure that you capture everything.
On top of the added complications, it's often not free to search or to file that claim either. So at times it doesn't make it very cost effective for people to do this on their own.
Right, and that's why a lot of us, you know, on the panel have services that you're able to utilize, and I don't mean that as a pitch, but, you know, the longer you're doing these things, you build out processes and services that you're able to offer for people to search for estates, to search for dates of death, to make it a little bit easier, because where I, like, mentioned that some of the Louisiana parishes before, some of these courts are not even online for you to be able to do a lot of the different things that you would want to have done. Sometimes you have to have people going into the courthouses to do searching for us.
This is true, and you're hearing more and more of that, Howard, because you're hearing, you know, we had things cut, so the court can't have 15 clerks sitting here answering the phone or et cetera. You know, now we have one person in here who is handling the mail, handling the calls, you know, but we've set up a public access for you that you can come into the court and handle those things.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, it'd be great if it was like bankruptcy where you know, have just the federal bankruptcy law and that's it. And the states don't really meddle with it, where, you know, there is a uniform probate code, but it's really not utilized very much. And the states all have different rules. I mean, I don't know if it was Tracy or Donna mentioned, like, the different colored paper. I literally worked in a courthouse where if you didn't put your filing on a blue backer, they would send it back to you just because it didn't have the blue backer. You're dealing with a a different level of bureaucracy when you're dealing on, with the counties than even what you see with the states from a federal level.
Joe, you had mentioned community property before. How do deceased collections work differently in community property states?
First of all, just to make sure everybody understands, that's a very broad term when you use the word community property states. And what community property, the general concept of a community property state is that for certain types of deaths, the spouse is responsible for that debt. That spouse, the surviving spouse, is going to be responsible for that debt. General, the type of expenses that you'd expect would be incurred in connection with basically a home and regular living expenses and those types of things. Those liabilities are joint. That's the overall premise of it. The problem is that there are so many nuances on it that you really need to study it on a state by state basis as you're digging in. For instance, Illinois has it's really not a community property state, but it's got a doctrine of necessities that is pretty broad for purposes of determining who's responsible for the medical debts or other debts that are associated with care of a person who's deceased. So that may work fine if you're trying to collect from a relative of the deceased, but it may not work in the next state over. So again, I'd made that point before, but it's a job. The job is to dig in and figure out what your rights are in that particular state you're collecting in.
And this is Tracy, just an additional comment on top of Joe's. I would say in maybe being wary of too broadly adopting a strategy on community property or doctrine of necessaries, because it really depends on when they were married, when the debt was incurred, and what you don't want to do is have a situation where your account rep is the one making the decisions then on whether to hold the spouse liable. And it's just going to cause more risk and harm.
So was it better tackled on a case by case basis then?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, on your initial conversation, I wouldn't even be pushing it. It's more of an inquiry to get the information to figure out where to go, because to Tracy's point, you don't want to get caught in a situation where you're saying something that's not legally accurate.
I think it's going to come down to practically, what's the amount of the debt? If you're talking about a very large debt, And it's worthwhile engaging some legal representation to ferret it out and figure out whether the creditor's got the right to collect it. Well, that's one thing. But if it's just a smaller debt that he couldn't justify getting legal advice on, I think you just have to let it go and just try to collect that from the representative of the estate as opposed to a potential spouse or other family
right.
member.
Yeah, and I think that applies to multiple scenarios. Like, if there's a rejection of a claim by a personal representative, well, how far do you want to push it? How much does it matter to you? What's the expense that you're going to go through? What are the reputational risks? It really comes down to that on multiple levels.
Got it. We've got a number of questions that have come in, and I'm not sure how long it's going to take to get to all of these, so I'm just going to put my discussion topics to the side for a second. We had one question that was emailed in before the webinar started. I would like to know if we can add the court costs from probate court to the principal of the debt without violating the FDCPA. Is that possible or allowed?
Well, it depends. Dot, dot, dot. It depends on the state
law.
That
sounds like a lawyer answer.
And you know what? And I'm not one. But it depends on the state law. It depends on the contract that you have with your client. It depends on any number of things. So widely, it's not yes or no. It depends.
I think the analysis is going to be similar to the analysis you have in any debt you collect. I mean, under what circumstances can you recover court costs? Is it, if it's contractually allowed, in the contract under which you're bringing an action? Yes. Here you've got another overlay on top of that, though, too. Is there anything in the probate laws that applies or doesn't apply that would make it so you could or couldn't recover those?
Okay. We've never looked to do that.
And yeah, us as well.
It's just a cost of doing business. It may be mm-hmm. different from a law firm in doing things where you're going to come out with a legal document on the back end of it, but we've never done it in collections.
That might be the
agreed,
best answer. Or the best way to answer that question. Another question. Under the Economic Growth Regulatory Relief and Consumer Protection Act, private student loan borrowers need to be given the option to provide a designee of who would handle their student loan in the event of their death. If there is an executor of the estate, are we legally able to even speak with the designee provided by the student? Everyone's developing an awesome answer, I'm sure.
I'm just trying to think that one through.
I think you could speak to both, to be honest. I mean, I think it's just a matter of getting a copy of, if you have a copy of the loan and then verifying the person that you're speaking to. I don't think you're going to run into a legal issue, because that's really all you're talking about is they're going to be liability under the FDCPA if somebody brings an action for a third-party disclosure. So I don't think you're wrong in either scenario there and speaking to either of the people.
As long as you document it, I'm sure probably enough to kind of give you some coverage, correct?
Exactly. And that would be whether it's, because I saw one of the other questions put out there is whether it's an inbound call or an outbound call, you're still going to need to go through whether it's your internal verification requirements or client SLA driven verification requirements. You're going to need to know if you want to pass anything with the FTC, CFPB, or any lawsuit, that the person you're speaking to actually has the authority to speak on behalf of the person who passed away.
Got it.
That's where we run into probably, you look at the CFPB portal, that's where you see the bulk of the people complaining is, I called in and they wouldn't give me the information. Well, it's because we weren't able to verify that we're speaking to the right person, and we're just not allowed.
Better safe than sorry, I guess sometimes gets you in trouble. Can you file a probate claim on an out-of-statute debt?
I would not do that. I think the problem is that it's going to the estate is going to have the same exact rights as the deceased had, and so if this it's an out-of-stat debt. A lawsuit on that debt could easily result in an FDCPA claim, and that could be a claim of the estate as opposed to the deceased.
Right, and it's kind of funny because a lot of that's been really driven by the judiciary more so than actually by the law, because the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense, meaning that the defendant needs to raise it in order for it to come into play. So that's why you're able to collect on out-of-stat debt. You can even sue on out-of-stat debt if you wanted to. But the courts recently have really, over the past couple of years, have sort of ignored the fact that it's an affirmative defense and just come out and say, it could be a violation of the FDCPA if you know you're collecting on a debt that potentially is not owed anymore.
Well, you've got case law that even says that you now have to disclose the fact that it's out-of-stat and that you can't bring an action to enforce it. So when you go ahead and file a lawsuit on it, there's a pretty straightforward claim that that's a violation of the FDCPA. I agree with Howard, though, that that's an unfortunate development in the law because it is an affirmative defense, and it's something that is only, you know, from a legal standpoint, should only come up if it raises an affirmative defense, but the courts have expanded that.
Right, the courts are doing it for them these days, so.
Right.
We have a question from an auto loan creditor. We sometimes get calls from deceased customers' family members asking to be added to the deceased customer's account and title so they can continue registering the vehicle while paying the debt. How are we to handle these cases as a creditor without knowing if there are other heirs who are more entitled to that vehicle before the probate is done?
Well, unless they have documentation that they can speak on behalf of the debtor, that would be the first question that I would have is, you know, do you have documentation that you can provide to us that you are the party handling the matters? And then if they can and you proceed, basically asking them, what's the status of the estate? Have you probated the estate? Have you went into the county court in your jurisdiction to determine what you need to do? You know, we can't just add you or, you know, transfer title, typically without some type of probate action, because again, it's an asset that was of the deceased.
And to me, I think it's why more and more unsecured creditors have also gone away from the assumption process. Because along with the benefit, there's also a burden of the credit as well. So to me, with the auto lender, it veers in a direction where they're making decisions that they may not have all of the information to make.
And the practical reality is, let's say you gave it to somebody who, you know, answers all the right questions, and when we're talking about, you know, verifying or confirming that the executor is who they are, it's asking, you know, questions about, you know, last four digits of the social of the person, about the last known, you know, the last known address, those sorts of things, just to verify as much as you can that you're dealing with the proper person, hoping that they're not lying about it. And once you do that, the reality is, if you were to give the car to somebody who's, let's say, the executor, but they're not the one who actually should have the car in their name, it should be a son or a daughter. The way that plays out is really, you know, and Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, it's really more of a will contest where the person who actually is entitled to it would file an action against the person who now has the title in their name without really any real ramifications to the creditor. I think it would just be a matter of making the changes if the court ordered you to do it.
Right, I agree.
And another question, what would your advice be when a personal representative rejects a probate claim?
I guess it depends on how much the claim is and how solid you feel the claim is.
Right, and why?
Yeah, that would be my first question is, why is the claim being rejected or disallowed?
Got it, okay. Moving back to some of our original discussion topics, what I'd like to do maybe now is ask, I think we talked about it a little bit, but just to summarize or to circle back or to make sure we sort of specifically talk about it, what's the best way to identify the executor or administrator of an estate? Tracy, maybe you can take that one for me, please.
Sure. So scrubbing accounts through some type of a probated estate database is one way of identifying. When somebody petitions the probated estate, you more often than not are identifying who will be handling it ongoing as well. But honestly, the more common way of identifying who your right party contact is going to be is through call and letter efforts. And then I believe more than a couple people have referred to the language within the FTC policy statement about how you go about confirming that they are the person authorized to handle the outstanding bills of the estate.
Okay.
Excellent, thank you. For a smaller agency, let's say one that doesn't have the robust processes and policies that or processes that many of you have, what are some of the best probate discovery options for those kinds of companies?
It's really not going to be any different than what we go through. I mean, your best resource is still going to be the local courthouse where the person resided, you know, going to the, you know, whether it's going, sending somebody in or calling or whatever their process is contacting the county level court that handles probate matters, where the person passed away is the starting point. It's not going to be, we have bigger databases that we've already built that we utilize, but the same information's out there if you wanted to, you know, for the one-offs to go and just go to the courthouse.
I agree. I think that's work. I mean, you got to go and see what the assets are, how many claims there are, whether there's, you know, any chance you're going to get paid or whether you're getting overlooked. It's just going to take somebody that understands how to read these court documents to get them and interpret them.
And I think that's why it's not a real big, you know, in our space. I mean, there's probably, you know, I don't even know how many law firms, but from an agency perspective, there's only, you know, a handful of us, maybe less than 10 that do this on a really, you know, sizable scale. Just for those reasons. I mean, you have to aggregate data over years in order to really, to make it a little bit smoother of a process and to make it a more efficient process.
Yeah, and as we know, all of the different counties have different resources to obtain that information. So one may be you have to send the letter with the fees, as Tracy had said before, you know, that probate isn't always free. Fees to file for the search to determine if there's an estate, fee to file the claim, fee to release the claim. You could make a contact to the court via telephone to see if you could obtain information that way. But I agree with Howard. Over the years, we've built these processes so they run at a smoother scale.
Yeah, and to add another level of complexity to it, you know, just because the person passed away and you do your search, let's say 90 days after the person passes away, and it turns up that there's nothing there. Well, that doesn't mean that it's not going to be there 30 days after that, 60 days after that. You have to do continual searching. It's still a matter of somebody passes away, you're going through all their belongings, and out pops a will. That could be day one. That could be, you know, 6 months into it. You never know when it's going to happen. So that's why, you know, I think when we talked about it earlier with whether there's basically a bar date for filing claims, it's all driven off of a filing generally, because you never know when somebody's going to find that, you know, that document that's necessary to actually do something.
Well, and to circle back to your statement prior, Howard, you know, you may have somebody who has property in different states and the family is not even aware of it in the very beginning until they do that research.
And if the person passed away is the one who handles the bills, oftentimes they have no idea when they receive our letter and they're talking to us that some of these things even existed.
Correct. I mean, I've seen estates open years after because someone will call and say, well, we didn't realize we had to probate. Now we want to sell the property. Oh, okay.
That leads me to my next question. I think we touched on it a little bit, but, you know, we've talked about how to find the executor or administrator, but are there ways to identify what assets an individual may have had or an estate may have to see if there's anything worth, you know, attempting to collect?
This is Joe Master. I think that, yes, this goes back to looking at the court filings. I think the biggest challenge in this business is knowing whether that's accurate or not, because I think some of us have alluded to the fact that people don't necessarily follow the probate laws and don't necessarily, they just kind of go about distributing the assets the way they think that grandma wanted them distributed without actually complying with the law, whether they do that intentionally or not. So that's probably your largest challenge. And I couldn't even begin to tell you how you figure that out, whether people are, you know, I mean, obviously you can read court documents and you can figure out what, you know, assets are and how many creditors there are and that type of thing. But if people aren't following the right procedures, I don't know how you figure out what assets were there and if they're being improperly distributed. And I'd like to hear what some ideas on that are.
Certainly, if it is through the probated process, you can request an inventory, which I believe is exactly what Joe was alluding to as well, so that you can try to gauge what are the other assets that are there. You can request credit bureaus if you have permissible purpose, certainly. Other asset search options through some other data aggregators are out there as well.
And the credit bureau is a good, even if you're just looking at attributes, it's a good indicator or a good source, because it's many times the person ends up in our office because they passed away, not because they weren't paying their bills while they were alive. It's not that all accounts are charging off. Most of these accounts that come into our offices charge off because the person passed away. So you're going to see a very different, you know, potentially a different profile than what you would if you're just looking at a, you know, like I said, credit attributes or credit bureau of a person who's in active collections and alive.
But the asset would need to show up on a credit report. So in other words, a house or a car, that type of thing. But things that wouldn't, obviously, let's say they had an art collection or they had jewelry or they had a wine collection. I mean, those types of things are just not going to show up in a credit report, and you'll just never know unless you're on the ground floor, and that's, you know, very difficult to be.
Oh, you've been rooting through my safe again, haven't you? A few more questions before we wrap up. Do claims accrue interest once approved by a court, like a judgment interest?
No. Generally, generally the answer is no.
Oh, see, I thought it was going to be
a caveat to that, because you're going to go to the balance that's owed is the date that the person passed away, and generally you're not going to see interest accrue after that. So you even have to go backwards to, you can't necessarily use the last billing statement. You really should be going back to the date that the person passed away.
Got it.
That's an important point, Howard, because I can just see an FDCPA claim there if you're seeking interest that you're not entitled to because you're looking for interest after the date the person passed away. That might have just saved our listeners, you know, some lawsuits there.
Look at that. Well done, Howard. How do you determine which creditor gets paid first? Is it from when the loan was established?
No, there's different classes associated with the probate. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I was just going to say it depends on what class. There's secured creditors, unsecured creditors. But go ahead. I didn't want to step on it.
No. No, you're more of the legal guy, but you know, there's classes to the probate, and you know, like class one will be expenses of the admin. Usually, typically, general creditors are the last class, which would be class seven, and in between those would be funeral related expenses, last illness expenses, family allowances is vary from state to state. Some states are at 50,000, other states are, you know, 60, 70,000. So it just varies in your specific state, but they all have similar classes, being that general creditors are the last class. Do we all agree on that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Look at that.
Specific to general unsecured. Secured debt would be paid out before unsecured.
Correct. Or if you had somebody who utilized someone else's account to pay for funeral expenses, and then that supersedes the unsecured claim.
But that would also generally be owed by the person who used it as an after-death charge.
Correct.
a client, we have a question that came in. I think it sort of speaks to what we were talking about at the beginning, but it's important. We have a group of accounts where the patient died in their facility. How should the collection envelopes be addressed when we have not yet identified the executor? Our client feels addressing the letter to the patient is insensitive given their constructive knowledge of the death, but addressing it to the estate of or the family of seems to reveal the existence of a debt. Does anyone have any suggestions?
We use the estate of on all of our letters, and the FTC and the policy was completely fine with that. It's really more the content of the letter. So you'd be able to put the estate of, you know, of Joe consumer, and then in the body of the letter, you would, you know, have your internal reference ID for your system, and the body of the letter would be, we're looking to find the person who's the executor, administrator, or individual authorized to pay the outstanding bills of the late, you know, Joe consumer. So you're not mentioning the creditor, you're not putting a mini Miranda at the bottom, you're not doing the validation notice language, or any state required language at the bottom of those letters until you know who the person is that actually is filling that role. Once you do that, you then send out a validation letter that contains all your notices. So they don't have any problem with using the estate of, but you need to be very careful with the language that you use, where they're very specific that by saying authorized to pay the outstanding bills, the government or the FTC viewed that much differently than to say the debts of the person or anything else. They did not view outstanding bills as language that that would disclose the existence of a debt.
It's interesting that they make that distinction. I look at it a little bit differently. They're in the FDCPA, you know, one of the most important things, whether something's covered by the FDCPA, it has to be a communication in connection with the collection of a debt. And when you're simply trying to figure out who the person is, who the right person is to talk to about a bill, I think that that is not necessarily going to be a communication with a communication in connection with the collection of a debt as defined under the FDCPA. But I think saying, you know, to the estate of is perfectly acceptable. I don't think that implies that there's you know, a debt that's owed.
Excellent. Well, we've just about reached the top of the hour, but before everyone starts hanging up en masse and before I let everybody go, what I'd like to do is go around the panel and have each of you take a second or a little longer than a second and offer a summary or offer any tips or anything you didn't get a chance to address today but felt was important. Just you know, some parting words of wisdom, for lack of a better term. Tracy, maybe you can go first.
Sure. And I just want to thank you, Mike, for allowing me to be a part of this and thank everyone. I think that if I were to summarize anything, it is the same way that we started it out, and remembering just again that this is a specialty type of debt and deserves to be treated in a special manner.
Excellent. Thank you. Howard?
And I couldn't agree more with what Tracy just said at the end of it. If it's something that you're not familiar with, I would reach out to somebody who knows, has a little bit more experience in doing it, because there could be very big ramifications for, you know, for your company, for the industry, and for your client if it's not handled properly.
Thank you very much. Joe?
Yeah, and I'd like to thank you, Mike, and Howard, Tracy, and Don. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. I guess two things I'd say. It's well worth it for people that are interested in this area to look at the FTC guidance, which is the publication. You can find it online, Debts and Deceased Relatives. It's available on the FTC's website. And the other point I'd make is this is an area that you definitely want to have smart people working on. In other words, you know, if you are going to go into this area, you want to have people that are doing the collection work that can understand the law and are getting good advice to understand the law, because there are a lot of pitfalls if you don't do that.
Excellent. Don?
Well, last but not least, again, thanks to everyone, Mike, as well as the rest of the panelists. I agree with everyone's statement. Just like to add that keeping in mind when you're dealing with the deceased collections, you're dealing with respect, integrity, and empathy. I think we've said it several times that, you know, specialty is key here, knowing the ins and outs, the do's and don'ts, having the people that are educated to speak clearly and know those specific laws, state laws, government laws, FTC policies, et cetera.
Excellent. Thank you. Before I let everyone go, I want to thank Don, Tracy, Joe, and Howard for their insights and their time today. Really appreciate them sharing their expertise and their knowledge with all of us. I also want to thank LexisNexis Risk Solutions one more time for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to risk.lexisnexis.com to learn more about the company. Thanks to everybody who participated and asked questions. One final reminder, please take a minute and fill out the feedback survey. Really appreciate that. This recording will be posted to accountsrecovery.net, hopefully within the next hour or so, so anyone who's looking for it can find it there. And please stay tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Panel, again, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.